This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. When my guest Janelle Monáe performed the opening song at this year's Oscars, electrifying the audience, it was an acknowledgement of her growing importance in the worlds of movies and music. She used it as an opportunity to describe her own identity, saying she was proud to be standing there as a Black queer artist telling stories. She first became known for her Afrofuturist funk soul hip-hop, in which she performed as her alter ego, an android named Cindy Mayweather. She often appeared in a tuxedo, wearing her hair in a high pompadour. She started her movie career with a bang. She co-starred in Hidden Figures, which was nominated for an Oscar in 2017. She also co-starred in the film that won Best Picture that year, Moonlight. In 2018, her album Dirty Computer was nominated for 2 Grammys, including Album of the Year. Now she stars in Season 2 of the Amazon series Homecoming, adapted from the Gimlet Fiction podcast of the same name, was a psychological thriller about a pharmaceutical company that was secretly treating war veterans suffering from PTSD with a drug that erased their memories. In Season 1, Julia Roberts starred as a counselor in the treatment program. Season 2 starts with Janelle Monáe's character waking up in a rowboat in the middle of a lake. Using her hands as paddles, she makes it to the shore, but she has no idea where she is or who she is. Walking down a road in a daze, she's picked up by a policewoman who tries to help her. At the officer's suggestion, she searches her pocket for some ID and finds one which says her name is Jacqueline. The police officer takes her to a hospital, where she's questioned by a doctor.
Jacqueline, what brings you here tonight?
Police officer brought me here.
Mm-hmm. I spoke with her and she said that you're feeling a little disoriented.
Yes, I am.
Mm-hmm. We're trying to understand what happened to you. You said there was a guy with you. Did he hit you in the head?
I don't know.
Okay. I'm just gonna do a quick exam. Jacqueline, what is your address?
I don't know.
Okay. How about your birthday? What's your birthday?
I don't know.
Janelle Monáe, welcome to Fresh Air. First of all, how are you?
Well, you know, I'm just trying to understand what time it is, what day it is, what world I'm living in. I feel like I'm in an alternate universe.
It's funny you should say that because so much of your music takes place in an alternate universe, and here you are living one, but not the one you imagined. So let's talk a little bit about Homecoming. Your character doesn't know who she is. She doesn't remember her own identity. Since identity has been at the heart of your music, performing and recording for years in a persona as a futuristic android, and then performing in your own identity as a queer African-American woman, did you find things you could relate to about your character in Homecoming because identity and her lack of knowledge of her own identity is so central?
Yeah, you know, there are some similarities, but we are not as alike as one would think, which is why I wanted to take the role. She wakes up in this boat, my character Jackie, and she doesn't know who she is. She doesn't know how she got there. So she is on this journey of self-discovery and trying to uncover her identity. And as soon as she thinks that she's getting closer to the truth, you know, she's getting closer to a lie. And so we get an opportunity to go on this wild ride with her.
The series also makes me think a little bit about your 2018 album, Dirty Computer, which I should mention that the album also has like a 45-minute narrative film that has a lot of the music from the album in it, and you play Jane 57821 in a futuristic society where people who don't conform are considered dirty computers, and they have to be cleaned, which means like their memories are cleaned too. So did you feel some resonance with that aspect of the story?
Sure. You know, I've been thinking a lot about what it means to live in a world where you are the minority, where you are a part of a marginalized group of people. And what happens when when those in the position of power strip you of your identity and strip you of the things that make you special and that help make this country special and this world special.
In Dirty Computer, your character says in the film version of it, this is a society where people who don't conform are dirty computers. People began vanishing. You were dirty if you looked different, showed any form of opposition at all. If you were dirty, it was only a matter of time. And you're told to recite, I am a dirty computer. I am ready to be clean. And I know you've said you relate to this idea that you created because you felt so marginalized, you felt like such an outsider for so much of your life. I'm wondering how it felt to open the Oscars, to have the opening song on the Oscars and declare your pride to be standing there as a Black queer artist.
Well, I mean, I think I made the statement, you know, throughout music and Dirty Computer. And if, you know, you listen even to my first album, I have a song on there called Mushrooms and Roses. Second album, you know, I spoke about it. I think one of the things that I was dealing with was abandonment issues. And my dad, you know, growing up, and we're very close, you know, now, and he's like, you know, my best friend, and he's doing so much better. But one of the things that I dealt with growing up was my father was in and out of my life, you know, on drugs, in and out of prison, and he was really sick. And I didn't realize that all of my, I guess, lack of not opening up was tied to having these abandonment issues, that perhaps if I, you know, told my family, which ultimately, if you make statements like that, your family's going to hear, you know, and they're going to be like, what? We didn't know. And as loving as my family was, I thought, well, what if they abandoned me? You know, because I come from a Baptist family who's very religious. You know, I grew up listening to certain pastors say to me and say to the congregation, you know, if you are not heterosexual, or if you're gay or bisexual or queer, you know, you're going to hell. And for me, a lot of it had to do with, well, what would my family think? Well, like, I don't want my family to abandon me in the same way that I felt like my dad did growing up. And you know, you start thinking about your fans, and you start thinking about, well, what if people say that I'm opening up now because I want to sell albums? People have said that, and they said that about other folks. And what if people, you know, if I open up, what if they say I don't want to buy her albums anymore? You know, it was this need of I needed to heal, and I did, and I healed through therapy. I healed through conversations. You know, it turns out not everybody in my family understands, you know, what it means to be me and what it means to be a part of the LGBTQIA+ communities. But I'm educating them, and they're finding out. And you know, it took having those conversations for me to feel comfortable enough to stand up on the Oscars, to stand on the records that I made, and to stand for what I represent right now.
Let's hear some of your music. A great track from your 2018 album, Dirty Computer, is called Make Me Feel.
Yeah. Baby, don't make me spell it out for you. All of the feelings that I got for you can't be explained, but I can try for you. Yeah, baby, don't make me spell it out for you. You keep on asking me the same questions. Why? And second guessing all my intentions. Should know by the way I use my compression that you got the answers to my confessions. It's like I'm powerful with a little bit of tender and emotional. Sexual bender, mess me up, yeah, but no one does it better. There's nothing better. That's just the way you make me feel.
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 Uh-huh. So good, so good, so good, so real. Uh-huh. That's just the way you make me feel.
That's just the way you make me feel.
That's just the way you make me feel.
You know I love.
please don't stop it.
That's Janelle Monáe doing her song Make Me Feel from her 2018 album Dirty Computer, and that's her latest album. There's definitely a Prince influence in that song. Did you sample him in that?
No, I did not. I didn't sample him. Prince, however, was working with me on Dirty Computer before he transitioned on, and I was in the middle. It was difficult for me to finish the album because of that. And Prince was helping, sending me song inspirations, and we were going back and forth. And so when he transitioned on, I felt that I had to continue to finish that album. And I was always asking myself, what would Prince do in these moments whenever I couldn't figure out, you know, a lyric or music or instrumentation or melody?
There's a song I want to play from your first album, and I played this the first time we talked, which was when your first album came out, and the song is called Sincerely Jane, and you had told me then that it was based on a letter that your mother wrote to you. Before we hear the song, and I really love this track, can you tell us about the letter that your mother wrote to you that inspired the song?
When I moved away, I want to say when I moved to New York for college, we would write letters to each other, and she would just keep me posted on what was going on. And I'm from Wyandotte County, Kansas City, Kansas, and Kansas City, Missouri is like 5 minutes away. It's like a bridge separates us. And a lot of my friends were being murdered. A lot of my friends, you know, from gun violence, and a lot of my cousins that I remember playing with growing up were, you know, unable to go to college. And if they did, some of them would just stay back home and kind of sell drugs. And some of my cousins were, in fact, selling drugs to our family members. And this isn't, you know, unique to me. You know, it just happens. You know, everybody is hustling. And I think that side of me hearing that was just so discouraging, and it made me, you know, my heart weep. And when it was time to write songs, I could only write from my experiences and the things that were bugging me and bothering me. And, you know, one of the lines in that song is, are we really living or just walking dead? And everything wasn't all bad, you know, growing up. Like, I just want to be clear about that. I had some of the best summers of my life with my family. And when you grow up in a big family like I have, you know, with over 50 first cousins and lots of aunts, and you know what I'm saying? It's your own community. You're swimming together. You're singing together. You're popping fireworks together. You are watching movies together. I mean, I used to watch a lot of films, scary movies. Horror is one of my favorite genres. And I remember watching Freddy Krueger and Child's Play and Halloween, you know, with my cousins, and my nose would be bleeding. Don't ask me why, and I loved every moment of it.
So the letter that your mother wrote you that inspired the song we're going to hear, what did she tell you in the letter?
A lot of you guys listen to the lyrics. I actually haven't listened to that song in a very long time, so I can't really quote any lyrics right now, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, I can. So hang on, because I wrote them down, so I have them.
And some of the lyrics, oh my goodness, I'm actually cringing at the thought of you playing this song, because some of the lyrics I just don't believe in anymore. Like, I think there's something in the second verse.
Well, this might be it, because I was going to ask you about this. It's danger. There's danger when you take off your clothes. All your dreams go down the drain, girl. Is that the line you're thinking of?
Yeah, I hate that line. I wish I didn't write that
line. Tell me why. I was really curious about that line.
Because it's not true. It's just not true. And I think when you grow up, you know, in Baptist community, you grow up in fear and people saying, you know, if you behave this way, you know, you're not going to go to heaven, you know. And I think as embarrassed as I am, you know, it's important to take a look at that and understand that artists change. Artists change their based on the information about yourself and about the world, and understanding that women have been oppressed for so many years and told that we shouldn't dress like this, that's too sexy, or, you know, we're trying, we're looking for attention, and that if you get raped or if someone sexually assaults you, it's because of something you did. And I think that that was also something that was pushed to me, that, you know, cover up, don't be too provocative, you know, and it's BS.
Well, I thought maybe your mother was warning you with the line, danger, there's danger, when you take off your clothes, all your dreams go down the drain. I thought maybe it was your mother saying, like, don't get pregnant.
You know what? It maybe could have been. But whenever I listen to it, I want to take responsibility for that lyric. And I think I don't want to put that on my mama. that was something I wrote.
Well, I want to play this song because I know it might not mean that much to you anymore, but I think it's really great. And another thing that's great about this song is the arrangement. I mean, you have timpani and French horns. And I remember you telling me when we had the first interview that you used to go to the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra a lot and listen to them. And I think it's really great that as a young artist that you are ambitious enough to find a way to work all of that in.
Yeah. You know, I guess one of the things that I love, and then when I look back, I'm realizing that there were just, you know, hints of eclecticism and just like freedom, you know, even though there were always folks, you know, in your community trying to keep you in a corner and control you. And sometimes people use religion to do that and certain things. There was still exploration in me, and I'm just thankful for that. And there's still wanting to bridge, you know, lots of different styles of music and figuring out how to learn from different cultures. And I love string arrangements. I love timpanis. I love watching the orchestra just as much as I love, you know, a grimy hip hop song or a rap song. I love jazz, you know. We love all these different things, and I don't believe in, I don't look at music in a binary way.
All right, well, let's hear Sincerely Jane, and this is from Janelle Monáe's first album.
Left the city, my mama, she said, don't come back home. These kids round killing each other, they lost their minds, they gone. They quit in school making babies and can barely reach them, gone off to their war. Lord have mercy on them. 1, 2, 3, 4 cousins is round here selling dope. Why daddy's your uncle is walking round strung out. Babies with babies and their tears keep burning while the dreams go down the drain now.
While the dreams go down the drain now.
Oh, we're really living or just walking dead now.
Oh, are we walking dead now?
Or dreaming of a hope riding the wings of angels.
That was Sincerely Jane from Janelle Monáe's first album. I know you had a grandmother who served food in jail for about 30 years. Did she tell you stories about jail, and did she try to talk to you and her other grandchildren about never doing anything that might land you in jail?
Yeah, for sure. You know, it was my grandmother actually served food in the county jail. for like 25 years. And so she would see a lot of people come in and out. And my grandmother was the type of person. Her name was Bessie. And she would let people who, you know, had murdered folks and who had robbed people after they got out of jail because they had met her in jail and they all called her mama. She would let them come live with her. And they didn't do anything to her. And they actually got back on the right track. My grandmother was very forgiving and inviting. And I wish I had more of that, you know, in me, because I was like, Grandma, I don't know what you're doing. Like, get these people out of here growing up.
So did you get to spend time with them?
I did. And that changed my way of thinking, because you're taught, like, you know, everybody is their past. But people, I think they can change. You know, I think rehabilitation and good mentorship, I think all of that can change people. And I think that people who are coming out of prison and trying to make a life for themselves should get that opportunity.
One last question. How are you trying to move forward with what you're trying to do during the pandemic when you're basically just staying home?
It's hard. I had a line of shows. You know, I was actually going to be performing with at the Hollywood Bowl this June with an orchestra. You know, I was looking forward to it, and I was going to be headlining Pride in New York. And all of that, you know, has gotten postponed. And there was a movie, Antebellum, you know, which was going to be my first lead role, that was scheduled to come out in April. And that's postponed as well. But I'm not in the same predicament as, let's say, like a single mom with five kids who just got laid off. And so what I'm doing is I'm understanding that, yes, we are all going through different stages of this, and it's impacting us in ways. But it's like, listen, we're going to have to pull together and help one another. And one of the things that I am doing is I'm not making music right now. I'm not really inspired, because music is so rooted to my reality. And right now I'm having a hard time grasping reality. I'm having a hard time understanding this new reality. And that's what I've been trying to do, and just realizing that we can't depend on this administration right now. You know, we're going to have to listen to the scientists, and we're going to have to continue to uplift the real heroes who are our essential workers, you know, the nurses and the doctors and those who are delivering our food for us and risking their lives and their own health to ensure that we have what we need.
Janelle Monae, thank you so much for talking with us. I wish you good health during this pandemic, and I look forward to hearing and seeing more of you. Thank you so much.
Oh, likewise, Terry. Thank you so, so very much.
Janelle Monae stars in the new season of Homecoming, which is now streaming on Amazon. Her latest album is called Dirty Computer. The animated Japanese film Tokyo Godfathers has been restored and can now be seen on most big video on demand services. It's about three homeless people who look after an abandoned baby. It was originally released in 2003. Our critic at large, John Power, says the movie seems even better and more relevant today than it did when he first saw it.
We never seem to get enough of stories about cool people who live on the margins of society. High-rolling gangsters, high-end strippers, high school chem teachers who sell crystal meth. We have less time for those whose life on the margins isn't cool. Day laborers, residents of nursing homes, people who live on the streets. We fear that stories about them will be depressing, or preachy, or both. The ideal antidote to this fear is Tokyo Godfathers, a marvelous Japanese animated film by Satoshi Kon, whose death at age 46 cheated the world of its most interesting animator. Almost nobody in the U.S. saw the initial release in 2004, but happily, a restored new version has become available on VOD, to be followed by a Blu-ray in June. Funny, touching, and exceedingly entertaining, Tokyo Godfathers is an upbeat fable about three social outcasts that never sinks into moralizing or treacle. It begins on Christmas Eve with children singing Silent Night at a nativity scene. Their audience includes our three heroes, who share a cardboard shack in the shadows of prosperous Tokyo high-rises. There's the bearded alcoholic Jin, a gruff middle-aged man who lives from drink to drink. The runaway teenager Miyuki, who's got a real mouth on her. and the gigantic cross-dressing Hannah, a one-time drag performer whose gap-toothed smile is as striking as her turban. They're digging through a trash heap when they come across an abandoned baby. This discovery launches them into a wild jaunt through the snowy streets of Tokyo, from gaudy neon boulevards and palatial hotels to sardine can subway trains and dark, dangerous alleyways. Along the way, our tattered, smelly trio meets up with doctors and Yakuza dons, nightclub owners and hooligans who enjoy beating up the homeless. Their journey also leads them into the past, letting us see the unhappy family lives that led them to be on the street. Here, in the dub version, you can get subtitles if you prefer, Jin and Miyuki try to convince the maternal Hannah that they can't keep the baby, but must take her to the police.
How in the hell are you going to raise a child? You're homeless, for Christ's sake.
I know. It's just, I don't want her to go from one foster home to another without ever feeling truly loved. The thought of sending her to that kind of life.
Lots of kids know what that's like. You don't have to be abandoned.
I get it, but the parents must have had their reasons.
What reason could anyone have for abandoning their child? There's no excuse. Her parents threw her away. Like she was trash.
I'm not saying you're wrong, but what can we do about it?
If Tokyo Godfathers sounds familiar, that's because its premise, a riff on the tale of the three wise men, has been used over and over since the silent movie days. I've seen at least five versions, ranging from a John Wayne Western to a French farce that inspired the Hollywood comedy Three Men and a Baby. Of the bunch, this is my favorite. That's because Satoshi Kon's work always aims high. If Hayao Miyazaki is Japanese animation's great mythmaker, Kon, one might say, is its radical psychotherapist. His movies explore Japan's cultural unconscious by revealing things that society usually ignores. The misogyny that shapes its J-pop girl groups. The dark, crazy dreams that lurk within innocent figures like Hello Kitty. Or the homeless people who folks literally step over on the Tokyo sidewalks. And he does all this in images that pop with vivid beauty, worthy of Japanese woodcuts, and are as tightly edited as a Hitchcock thriller. By his standards, Tokyo Godfathers is unabashedly straightforward and warm-hearted. We come to see Jin, Miyuki, and Hana not as generic losers, to use a familiar term these days, but as individuals who possess both self-destructive flaws and big-souled virtues. Much like the wonderful 2018 film Shoplifters, Kon takes outsiders who strike us as alien and annoying, and then shows them to be every bit as decent and generous as the respectable citizens who look down on them. Maybe more so. Coming from fractured traditional families, they find support in the alternative family that they've created together in their cardboard home. It's only natural that these improbable magi would look after a foundling. Now, few things are harder than capturing goodness on screen, and I must confess that there are a couple of moments in Tokyo Godfathers that fall into cuteness or sentimentality. But I forgave that when I first saw it back in 2004, and I forgive it even more now. In these days when tens of millions are out of work and don't know what the future holds, I can't fault a film for showing too much compassion and love for characters who must struggle just to get by.
John Powers is Fresh Air's critic at large. He reviewed the newly restored animated film Tokyo Godfathers. Coming up, we'll talk about, so how's your anxiety level been? My guest, Dan Harris, has been trying to help people quiet their anxiety and panic during the pandemic with meditation and mindfulness techniques. He's been hosting a daily meditation online with different leaders in the mindfulness community, and he hosts a podcast twice a week where he interviews various meditation teachers as well as researchers who study the neurological and biological effects of meditation. Harris doesn't pass himself off as a guru. He's actually a newsman, a correspondent for ABC News, and host of the weekend edition of Good Morning America. He was also a co-anchor of Nightline until he left last year. A live on-air panic attack on Good Morning America back in 2004 is one of the reasons he got into meditation. His podcast, online sessions, and an app are an outgrowth of his 2014 book, 10% Happier, a memoir about how he discovered meditation and how it tamed the negative voice in his head. Dan Harris, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
So how is the pandemic affecting your anxiety level?
It is definitely affecting my anxiety level. I've taken to saying if you're not anxious right now, you're not paying attention. I don't think we should sugarcoat it. It's scary. And you know, we're not wired as a species for uncertainty. And we are living with really grave uncertainty. And I find that I go through this loop where I try to project into the future to plan. And every time I project, I bump up against a wall of fog because I have no idea what's going to happen. And that looping, that continuous process of trying to plan and then bumping up against the fog and then getting a little squirt of adrenaline in my brain, like a fight or flight response to the uncertainty over and over, is very painful. And I'm so glad I have meditation on board, because now I am catching that process and able to sort of let it go much more than I would have if I entered into this pandemic without having had a 11 years of meditation under my belt.
Well, how is meditation helping you deal with uncertainty? Because that is a real thing that we're all going through. I mean, you try to look ahead and we really don't know. I mean, to be really honest, some of us are thinking, who knows if I'll even be alive? I mean, it's a virus that is killing a lot of people. So you don't know if you'll have a job. You don't know if you'll be working at home or at the office. You don't know how you're going to get to your job if you have a job. You don't know about your income. And all these things can strike terror. So, like you said, you know, fear is a very rational response to what we're dealing with now. So what story are you telling yourself when you bump into that fog and uncertainty and fear about the future? What's the narrative in your head?
Well, I'll tell you what one, I'm going to answer that in the affirmative. I'll tell you what the narrative is, but let me just tell you what the narrative is not. Meditation doesn't make the uncertainty go away. There are no silver bullets here, and that's why my little shtick is 10% happier. I'm trying to sort of counter-program against some of the reckless hope that I find peddled in certain corners of the self-help industry. It's not like I meditate and, you know, my life is just, you know, every time, you know, I'm walking through this pandemic like a unicorn barfing rainbows all the time. That's just, it doesn't work that way. What meditation allows you to do is to relax into the uncertainty, to be okay or a little bit more okay than you otherwise would have been with the uncertainty. So I catch myself projecting to the future. I catch these storylines. So, you know, I have elderly parents. I'm worried about my kid. He's 5. Or I worry about my company and our employees or my contract at ABC News. Any, you know, and I'm, by the way, on the way far end of the privilege scale. You know, I'm very, very lucky. And I'm worrying. So how anxiety provoking must all of this be for people who have lost a job or lost someone or worried that they may lose their life imminently? So all of that comes up for me. And can I just catch that this is happening? And instead of our habitual responses, which are fighting it, feeding it, or trying to numb out with, I don't know, alcohol, shopping, gambling, drugs, can I just sit with it? Can I just let it be there and investigate it with some curiosity and with some warmth? And so we can talk about the blocking and tackling of how you do that in meditation, but that is the move. It doesn't make it go away. It just means that you're able to see that the fear, like everything in the world, will come and go, and that if you just relax for a second and breathe into it, it will come and go. And then once you're on the other end of it, you can make calmer, saner decisions. And that the one cliche about meditation that I really love is that it teaches you how to respond wisely to things instead of reacting blindly. And so we want to respect our fear, but we don't want to be owned by it.
Let's talk about what led you to meditation. Let's start with your live on-air panic attack in 2004, which I feel so bad for you watching it. Describe it from your perspective. What was going on for you? And this was in 2004. You were, I think, around 32 years old, and you were reading a live news update on Good Morning America in front of around 5 million people.
Yeah, and I just basically lost the ability to breathe. I started to, you know, I'd never had this. I'd had minor stage fright before, which is weird for somebody going into TV news. I think I described my career as a triumph of narcissism over fear in my book. But I never had something like this, where I just really, my lungs seized up, my palms started sweating, my mouth dried up. I just couldn't speak, which is inconvenient if you're trying to anchor the news. And then my mind really freaked out in response to the physiological stuff that was going on, and that made the physiological stuff worse, and that made my mind worse, and then it becomes a downward spiral. And so I had to quit in the middle of my little newscast. I was filling in as the news reader that morning. That's the person who comes on at the top of each hour and reads a few headlines. And the main anchors of the show at the time, Charlie Gibson and Diane Sawyer, looked quite surprised when I, just a few seconds into my shtick, said, back to you. And it was really embarrassing.
They let you back on the air after that. Were you afraid that that was the end of your broadcast career?
Yes. After it happened, everybody said, what happened? And I lied and said, I don't know. And I guess they believed it, and because they let me on the air the next hour, and I was fine. But when I went backstage, my mom called me and said, you just had a panic attack. And I knew I'd had a panic attack, too. Mm-hmm. And so I went to go see a shrink. My mom hooked that up. And the shrink asked me a bunch of questions. And one of the questions was, do you do drugs? And I said, yes. And he gave me a look that communicated, okay, mystery solved. And the backstory here is that I had spent a lot of time as an ambitious young reporter after 9/11 in war zones, Iraq, Afghanistan, Israel, the West Bank, Gaza. And I'd come home and gotten depressed and had very unwisely started to self-medicate with recreational drugs. My drug career was pretty short-lived and intermittent. I wasn't high on the air or anything like that, but the shrink explained that it was enough to change my brain chemistry and make it more likely for me to freak out.
Explain a little bit more why drugs might lead to a panic attack, especially if you were taking it to feel better, not panicked.
So the primary drug I was abusing is cocaine. And so that just kind of raises, according to this doctor, the baseline level of adrenaline in your brain. And that's the key ingredient in panic attacks. So, yeah, it also, you know, what I've learned with panic is you're much more likely to panic when you're if you're prone to panic, you're more likely to actually freak out if you're dysregulated, if you haven't had enough sleep, if you've had too much coffee. And so the advice for dealing with panic that I've received is to kind of do all the things your mom tells you to do, which is get enough sleep, eat well, exercise, meditate, to keep yourself regulated, healthy, calm, and happy. And that lowers the odds that you'll freak out.
What is some of the most interesting scientific evidence you've learned about that various forms of meditation techniques can actually have a physiological effect on the body and a neurological effect?
I'll tell you about one study. This is actually not even a recent study, but it just made a huge impact on me. It was done at Massachusetts General Hospital. It took people who had never meditated before and scanned their brains. And then they had them do 8 weeks of a little bit of meditation every day. And then they scanned their brains again. And what they found was in the area of the brain associated with self-awareness and with compassion, the gray matter literally grew. And in the area of the brain associated with stress, the gray matter literally shrank. And that was just super compelling to me. And my mom, who was until recently a pathologist at Mass General and is a way more curmudgeonly and skeptical than her son, that study single-handedly convinced her to meditate. So yeah, it's just really, the neuroscience here is really exciting because it goes back to this thing that I keep harping on, which is that we can change. We can change our brains and by extension our minds. And that just goes against, first of all, it goes against received wisdom. The dogma in neuroscience for years was that the brain stopped changing after around the age of 25. But in fact, you can train the brain at any age. And the knock-on consequences for your inner life and your outer comportment are profound.
Let's get to the basics of meditation. It's not that fancy. So let's start with just like basic breathing meditation. Can you describe like a simple approach to that that you find to be effective?
Yes, I can. And you're absolutely right when you say it's not that fancy. And that's one of the things that helped me get over the hump to do this, because when I first, you know, met Dr. Epstein and started to poke around in meditation back in, you know, 2009, I think it was, I had a very bad attitude about it, just as I did with loving kindness meditation, which I adopted later. It's not uncommon for me to have a bad attitude generally, and I really did have that toward meditation. Actually, it's one of the things I'm kind of working on, my sort of tendency to reach snap judgments. And so I definitely did that with meditation, the snap judgment that this is for people who, you know, live in a yurt and are really into, you know, Cat Stevens. And that's not actually entirely wrong, but it was the science that helped me get over the hump. That, again, there are all these positive physiological, psychological, behavioral consequences to meditation. And what you just said about it not being fancy. Mindfulness meditation, which is the kind of meditation I'm going to describe, it's derived from Buddhism, but it has been thoroughly secularized and stripped of any metaphysical claims or religious lingo. It's a very simple exercise for your brain. So here's how you do it. You sit in a quiet enough spot, and you then bring your full attention to the feeling of your breath coming in and going out. You don't have to breathe in any special way. This is not actually a breathing exercise. And there's nothing special about the breath per se. We're just picking something south of your neck to pay attention. We're going to get your attention out of the swirling stories in your head and onto the raw data of your physical sensations. So it can be your breath. For some of us, the breath right now is triggering, given the fact that COVID-19 has pulmonary consequences. So you might want to pick just the feeling of your full body sitting or lying. Just picking some physical anchor where you can place your mind. And you just kind of commit to it gently, that I'm going to pay attention to this for 1 to 5 to 10 minutes. That's the second step. And then the third step, and the final step, really, and this is the most important step, is that as soon as you try to do this, your mind will go into mutiny mode. You're going to start thinking about, you know, when can I get a haircut? You know, where do gerbils run wild? Why did Dances with Wolves beat Goodfellas for Best Picture in 1991? Blah, blah, blah. And the whole game is just to notice when you've become distracted and to start again and again and again. And this distraction, by the way, is not a failure. It is not a malfunction. It is part of the meditation. The key part of meditation is to get distracted, to see the wildness of your own mind over and over and over again, and then to begin again and again and again. And it is the seeing of the wildness, of the cacophony, that is really important, because when you see it, it doesn't own you as much.
And if I'm not mistaken, mindfulness meditation is also about trying to really quiet those distractions and gain some control over them, but not in a way that you panic like, oh no, my mind is wandering, I'm bad at this. So it's not about that kind of self-criticism, but you suggest starting with focusing on an itch or the locality of a pain that you're having. Why is that a good place to start? And what would you be doing if you start with, say, itch?
Okay, so there's so much in what you just said that I just want to unpack. But just to go back to something you said at the beginning of that question about quieting the mind or controlling the mind, just want to tweak that slightly. It's actually not about trying to tamp down on or control the way the mind works. It's about familiarization, just getting to know how nutty it is inside your brain, inside your mind, is incredibly important, because when you've tipped over into panic or any other unhelpful, unskillful mind state like greed or anger or hatred, then you might notice it. And then you have a choice. Am I going to be owned by this panic right now? Or am I going to be owned by this anger right now? Or am I going to be so controlled by the anger that I'm going to say something that's going to ruin the next 48 hours of my marriage? Or am I going to eat the 75th Oreo? Having this self-awareness, otherwise known as mindfulness, which is what's developed through the process of seeing your distractions and then beginning again gently over and over and over again, that is a game-changing skill, because then this nonstop conversation that is this central feature of your life, whether you know it or not, we're all walking around with this inner narrator that if we broadcast aloud, you would be locked up. And when you're unaware of this cacophony internally, it's owning you all the time. And what we're doing in meditation is dragging all of this nonsense out of the shadows and into the light. And so it's not about controlling it. It's in some ways, the great meditation teacher Ram Dass once said, it's not that I've conquered my neuroses, I've become a connoisseur of them. And over time, you have a warmer, friendlier attitude toward all of the inner neurotic programs injected into you by the culture or by your parents or whatever, these habitual storylines, and then they aren't running you as much. And that is so, in my experience, so liberating.
Well, Dan Harris, I wish you and your family good health. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Dan Harris is the author of the book 10% Happier, hosts the podcast of the same name, and hosts a daily meditation online. He's also a co-anchor of the weekend edition of Good Morning America.